beginning. Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carmen. I'm president of the club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome our members here in the audience with their guests, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I just do want to remind you all of the speaker schedule we have ahead of us in the immediate future. On Friday, tomorrow, October 20th, Louis Rukeyser, host of Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, will be here to address the club in conjunction with the annual Financial Writers Conference that we sponsor. Next Tuesday, October 31st, the King of Norway, Harald V, will present a speech entitled Norway, a European and Atlantic Nation with a Global Outlook. And on Tuesday, November 7th, Ben Bradley, Vice President of the Washington Post, will reminisce about his life in journalism. Transcripts in audio and videotapes of press club luncheons are available, available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers, a book containing 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. And we'll do the same thing for this year, and we hope our guests will be included. But to order a copy of last year's book, to call a copy, 1-800-NPC-2334. Thank you very much. Now, if you have questions for our speaker, you'll find cards on the table. Please write your questions, pass them up to me, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Howard Glickman, Business Week magazine. Jackie Frank, Reuters News Service. Excuse me, Marie Coco, Newsday. Richard May, Staff Director of the House Budget Committee. Gary Idazak of the, he's Associate Editor of Kiplinger Washington Editors, skipping over our speakers for the moment. Doug Harbrecht, Business Week magazine and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Thank you, Doug. Sheila Cherry, Commerce Clearinghouse. Larry Haas, Associate Director, Office of Management and Budget. Roger Lowe of the Columbus Dispatch. And Christine Walton, Bloomberg Business News. And Al Fram of the Associated Press. We are fortunate to have two guests today. John Kasich, chairman of the House Budget Committee, likes to listen to a rock group called Pink Floyd. Alice Rivlin, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, doesn't know Pink Floyd from Dick Darman. Rivlin, a Democrat and native of Bloomington, Indiana, is an avowed Redskin fan. Kasich, a Republican lawmaker from Westerville, Ohio, roots for the Cleveland Indians. His team is on a roll right now, while the Redskins, well, they're improving.
We're coming back.
They're coming back. Both of our guests today, though, do know an outlay from an outfield. Economist Rivlin is a veteran of the Washington federal budget game. He's been OMB director since 1994, and she was founding director of the Congressional Budget Office and served in that post from 1975 to 1983. She's long been a champion of closing the federal deficit. John Kasich, a former congressional aide, was a young backbencher interested in budget issues when political lightning struck in November 1994. As the House of Representatives switched to GOP control for the first time since the Cleveland Indians were last in the World Series, Kasich was named chairman of the panel. Since then, he has earned a reputation as an energetic budget cutter, and he's instrumental in producing the Republican blueprint to balance the budget in 7 years. Indeed, our two guests know so much about the federal budget that I am going to ask them to suspend some of their knowledge And remember that our viewing and listening audiences aren't as familiar with the jargon of budgeting as they are. So in that context, I want to set forth, now you're going to hear a lot of disagreement today, but I want to set forth some areas of agreement between Democrats and Republicans over the budget. Both sides agree the budget should be balanced. Republicans want to do it in 7 years. President Clinton says it can be done and should be done in 10 years. Both sides agree that the growth in Medicare costs for the elderly must be slowed if the budget is to be balanced and the fund is to be saved from bankruptcy. President Clinton would pare $124 billion from Medicare costs over 7 years. The Republicans would slow the growth of spending by $270 billion. Both sides agree that the growth of the federal portion of the Medicaid program for the poor also must be slowed. President Clinton wants to shave $55 billion from that program. Republicans want to restrain the growth by $182 billion. The President thinks Medicaid should remain a federal entitlement available to all who qualify. Republicans say the program should be turned over to the states, which, they believe, can run the program much more efficiently. Both sides agree that the middle class should get tax relief. Both sides support a family tax credit. President Clinton says the full credit should apply only to families who earn $60,000 or less a year. Republicans would give the credit to families earning up to, and it depends which plan you're looking at, maybe $110,000, maybe to $200,000. Republicans also support a lower capital gains tax rate. President Clinton says a lower capital gains rate should be targeted to middle-class families. Both sides also agree that welfare should be reformed, but they disagree on how it should be done. However, President Clinton and Senate Republicans appear to be moving toward a mutually acceptable compromise. Having laid out all those broad areas of agreement, today the President announced that he will veto the budget reconciliation bill moving through Congress, which means he will veto the Republican tax cut, the Republican reduction in the growth in Medicare and Medicaid spending. I'm sure we'll hear lots of discussion about that today. Our format is as follows. Each speaker is allowed an 8-minute opening statement, followed by a 3-minute rebuttal. Question and answer period will follow, and our first speaker will be Ms. Rivlin.
Thank you very much, Bud. That was such a lucid introduction that maybe John and I could just retire and let you write the budget. Maybe we'll call on you when things get rough. I'm delighted to be here and to have another chance to discuss the budget with my friend, the distinguished and vigorous chairman of the House Budget Committee, John Kasich. Let me just make a few points. First, Clinton administration budget policy so far has been a spectacular success. The facts are very clear. We're not talking projections here. We're talking what has already happened. The Clinton administration started with an economy in the doldrums and a massive budget deficit that was headed up and was out of control. Now we have an economy whose aggregate statistics are an economist's dream, moderate, steady growth, and very low inflation. Unemployment is down, profits are up, exports are up. Even the difficult trade deficit seems to be coming down finally. Strong and solid are words that describe the overall performance of the economy in the 3 years since the nation elected Bill Clinton as president. And the deficit, which was $290 billion in fiscal year 1992 and headed up on anybody's projection, would have been way over $300 billion now, if nothing had been done. That deficit has come down from $290 billion to $160 billion this year. It has plummeted. It has fallen much faster than anyone predicted, even us. It's gone from 4.9% of the whole gross domestic product to 2.3%. Now, remember what Republicans said when they refused to vote for the president's deficit reduction plan. They said things like, it will put the economy in the tank, It won't really reduce the deficit. They're only doing it with smoke and mirrors. Well, look at the facts. We delivered. We reduced the deficit by a lot more than even we predicted. I'm stressing this because I want you to remember it when Chairman Kasich says that our current plan won't reduce the deficit. Now we are arguing, as Bud Kerman has said, with the Congress about how to finish the job. The good news is that both the administration and the Republican majority have the same objective, balance the budget. John Kasich and I, over a long period of years, have fought for this, and I think we're very pleased to be focused now on the same objective. We need to get rid of that persistent deficit that has paralyzed the federal government since the Reagan administration. But now we're arguing about how to do that, how to get to balance. The Congress and the country have a clear choice between two approaches to balancing the budget. On the one hand, we have the President's plan. It contains a moderate tax cut for families who need it, families raising kids on limited incomes and people who want to invest in their own and their children's education beyond high school. It's a budget that invests in future wage growth, training workers for better jobs, improving education, investing in science and technology, and it protects the environment. It streamlines government. It goes for a leaner and more responsive government with less bureaucracy. Now, we deliver on that, too. We don't just talk about it. 160,000 fewer people work for the federal government this year than at the start of the Clinton administration. And it is a budget with moderate spending cuts that will not destroy the programs like Medicare and Medicaid that vulnerable Americans depend on. The Republican plan, by contrast, has deep tax cuts, a large part of which go to people who don't need it. It has spending cuts concentrated on the most vulnerable. Families with children in the bottom 20% of the income distribution would lose, on the average, $3,200 per family in income and in health care, direct benefits. It has Medicare cuts and Medicaid cuts so deep that they threaten the future of our whole health care system. And it has deep cuts in programs that we need to grow the economy, education, technology, training, aid to students, and in programs that protect the environment. These cuts are harsh, they're extreme, they're unfair, they're unwise, and above all, they're unnecessary. The most serious problem facing the American economy over the next few years is that the wages and incomes of average people, especially people without skills and education necessary to hold high-paying jobs in this technological society, have lagged behind. I said at the beginning that the overall performance of the economy was an economist's dream. That's true, but it hides the big problem of the last 20 years. The fact that people with lots of education and other advantages have been doing very well. Those in the middle have been barely holding on, and those with low skills and education are falling, not just relatively, but absolutely behind. The Clinton administration wants to redress this imbalance, which is undermining our social fabric. That's why we are fighting for education reform and more effective training, for the earned income tax credit, which is effective assistance to working families. That's why we want an increase in the minimum wage and tax cuts for families education and welfare reform that moves people to work. The Republican budget would make the rich richer at the expense of low-income working families. It would slash the earned income tax credit, which means raising taxes on low-income working families. It would cut people off welfare without adequate work protection, without adequate work opportunities, and without adequate child care. It would cut education and student aid. It would destroy the Medicaid safety net for low-income families, the elderly, and the disabled. These cuts are not necessary. The President is eager at an appropriate moment to sit down with the leadership in Congress and craft a budget that reaches balance in a moderate, responsible way without the harsh extremism of the Republicans' budget. But to have a negotiation, the Congress must get its job done. They have been falling farther and farther behind their own schedule. They said they would have all the appropriations bills done by the start of the fiscal year. Well, in case you hadn't noticed, John, the fiscal year has started, and we have received 3 of the 13 bills, one of them only today. That meant that we needed a continuing resolution, and we may need another. Finally, a word about the debt limit. The debt limit is something we shouldn't be talking about. It's not really relevant to this discussion. It will have to be raised no matter how the budget debate comes out. If the Republicans' own resolution calls for a $600 million increase in the debt limit. Indeed, we'd have to raise it even if the budget was in balance. The Republicans are creating an artificial crisis by saying they won't raise the debt limit until the President agrees to balance on their terms. That's irresponsible, and if it happens, it will cost the government money. If we were to default or even come close, it would raise interest rates, not just for the government, which would make the budget deficit worse, but for the economy at large, everybody that has a mortgage. So I say to Chairman Kasich, we have a common goal, and we have a responsibility to the public to act quickly and responsibly. So urge your colleagues to finish their work, and then let's work together to make a budget that's good for America. Thank you.
Congressman Kasich.
Thank you. Maybe I can hold on here. I've always wanted to be in the NBA. Could have almost made it there. Well, I'm going to try to fit this in. I don't have any prepared remarks, but I want to talk to you. First of all, Bud, I didn't get struck by lightning into this job. In 1989, I fought my own president. It was a Kasich budget and a Bush budget and a Democrat budget. In fact, at one point, Martin Szabo ran to the House floor and voted for the Kasich budget because I was doing so poorly in the vote count, he didn't want me to be embarrassed. But as I said at the time, in responding to a journalist from my district, I don't care if I'm the only person offering an alternative, because when a guy at a gas station saw me and heard me complaining about the rotten plans I saw before us, he said, "Yeah, you can complain, but what would you do?" So I drove in my Jeep down to my office and informed my staff we'd write our own budget. In 89, I got about 29 votes. 28 other people thought I was doing all right. Then we went to about 64, then to about 89, and then finally I got more votes than President Bush got for his budget, because I believe that it was necessary to begin to deal with the tough issues, the tough fiscal issues. This is not about the budget. This is not about numbers. This is about whether we're going to preserve the future for the next generation. Now, let me just suggest to all of you that you ought to be thrilled with what the Republican majority on Capitol Hill is doing. The entire time that I've been in Washington, I have read commentary pieces by political observers, professors, analysts of the future economic trends of this country, and they all said one thing to the politicians on Capitol Hill: get the spending under control, deal with entitlements, make the hard choices, don't have sacred cows, go out and do the right thing and have the guts. So guess what? Republicans in a short period of time made a number of promises, and guess what is really amazing? The things that they said we couldn't do, which was to balance the budget, strengthen defense, provide tax relief to Americans, and preserve Medicare, they said, couldn't do it. Kasich, you can't do it. It's impossible. They're going to stick you with this. And I said, no, it's very possible. And we moved forward to do it. And we moved forward to do it in an intellectually honest way. That is what I have demanded from my colleagues. That is what my colleagues have demanded from me. We looked at all the programs of the federal government under the microscope, and we said we're going to be tough enough and bold enough to put America first. And frankly, if for no other reason, we should be complimented for, number one, keeping our word, and number two, for tackling the tough issues that politicians in this country have put off virtually all of my lifetime. And we're addressing it. We are slowing the growth in federal spending. Slowing the growth from $9.5 trillion over the last 7 years to $12.2 trillion in federal spending over the next 7 years. And by slowing the growth and making the necessary reforms that you have called for and we have believed is correct, we're on the glide path and the roadmap to saving this country
from fiscal bankruptcy and economic ruin. Now, folks, look, what's fair is fair. In 1993, I said we cannot criticize Bill Clinton's budget unless we have a plan. Remember that? I would walk out of committee rooms and my colleagues would tackle me in the hallway saying, John, you can't put anything down. If you lay a plan down, we're going to get killed out there. The media will go nuts. We had a group of media advisors come to one of our conferences, and they said, oh, you better not lay a plan down. You lay a plan down, the heat's going to be on you. I said, look, it's just like my dad said. You don't have an alternative. Don't criticize what is already out there. In 1993, the president said, we're going to use the Congressional Budget Office to score all the plans because they've been the most conservative, they've been the most accurate. And that's going to be the Bible. That's going to be the measuring stick of how we determine what really works, and we can eliminate the rosy scenarios. You know what the Republicans did when the president suggested we use CBO? We booed him. But you know what we did? We honored his commitment. And in 1993, using the Congressional Budget Office rules of estimating, we put together an alternative to the president that made the same amount of deficit reduction without one penny of tax increase. Now we come to 1995. This is the Republican budget proposal. It's passed, the budget resolution. It's passed. We're going to pass reconciliation very soon. See it? Pretty big, isn't it? This is the President of the United States budget package right here. One-third of it is charts criticizing our plan. Bud, you're wrong again. There is no President's budget plan to balance the budget in 10 years. Folks, let me tell you, what's going on, and what's fair is fair. We took the president's budget. We sent it to the Congressional Budget Office. We had it analyzed the same way ours is analyzed. And this calls into question your responsibility, or brings up the question of your responsibility. When we sent it to the Congressional Budget Office, they came back. And you know what they told us? The president has no plan to balance the budget. His plan puts us in debt by $200 billion a year. Now, folks, this is unbelievable. Let me tell you where it comes from. When you take the president's plan, do you realize that the president has wiped out listen to this number, folks. I don't know how we didn't get this out there before. $475 billion worth of deficits without lifting one program. The president says they're going to save $20 billion in discretionary spending on a bookkeeping function. They say that all entitlement spending is going to be $206 billion less than CBO says, without lifting anything. $474 billion in rosy scenario comprises the president's package. We have $1 trillion worth of savings. They don't even have $500 billion. And they're going to go around the country and say they have a better plan. They have no plan to balance the budget. And here's the height of irresponsibility. The president goes around and says, well, I don't have to affect you, ma'am, and I don't have to affect you, and I don't have to affect you, and I got this money. It's in the trunk of my car. But you know what? When you open up the trunk, folks, there's no money there. You can't balance the budget on smoke and mirrors and rosy scenarios. If you put the president's plan in the Congressional Budget Office that he asked us to do, he's got no plan to balance the budget, and he has no room, folks, to criticize us based on the principle that I operated on 1993. If you don't have a plan, right, folks, they're not in the ballpark. They're not on the field. They're not in the dugout. They haven't even left the hotel yet. And they're running around the country dividing us. If there's anything we ought to be doing in America, it's to stop dividing the country based on false promises. Now, we got a plan to do it, and you know why we're doing it? We're doing it for the kids, the next generation. If we miss this opportunity, I'm going to suggest to each and every one of you, if we miss this opportunity to do it, we won't do it until the economic ship hits the rocks in this country. If we do it, it's like Alan Greenspan said, not Newt's words, not Kasich's words, Greenspan's words. If you can balance the budget, you will eliminate the fear in the hearts of America's parents that their kids won't be better off, because their kids will be better off. And secondly, we will unleash an economic growth in this country that we can only dream about. Ladies and gentlemen, Let's end the gimmicks. Let's end the smoke and mirrors. Let's stop the "but I can't do it," and let's go for a plan that will fix this country, make the hard decisions, make it a fair plan, across all the tough programs, and at the end of the day, we'll save America. We will not pass a permanent increase in the debt ceiling until we can tell our bankers, the American people, that there's a way to get out of debt. And when we do it, we will raise the debt ceiling with the confidence that we've saved this country from fiscal and economic collapse. I hope the president will get out of the hotel and come out on the field.
Thank you very much. And now for a three-minute rebuttal, Ms. Rivlin.
Well, I told you that John Kasich and I agreed on the need to balance the budget, and he has reaffirmed that and emphasized its importance for the future. Why does it matter? It matters because we're not a very high-saving country, we Americans, and for the last 15 years, we've had the government borrowing a high proportion of the nation's savings to finance the government and not to invest in the future. So it matters. It matters to our children and our grandchildren, and I have some of those. That's why I don't know about Pink Floyd. There are several ways to do this protection of the future. John spoke of doing the right thing. Is raising taxes on working families the right thing? The Republican tax plan, by the Congress's own analysis, would raise taxes on families under $30,000. That's mostly because of reducing the earned income tax credit, an excellent program that makes work pay for people who don't have access to high-paying jobs. And it gives enormous benefits, over half the benefits, to people at the very high end of the income distribution, those over $100,000. Is that the right thing? Is cutting Medicaid by $182 billion the right thing, turning it into not an entitlement that will allow low-income people access to the health system, but a block grant to the states with less money, forcing on governors the choice, the very difficult choice, between elderly folks in nursing homes and poor children when there isn't enough money to go around? Is that the right thing to be doing? We care about the next generation, too. And one of the reasons we want to balance the budget is that we care about the next generation, but is the same reason that we want to improve education and schools. Balancing the budget at the expense of education, at the expense of training, at the expense of investing in technology and science is just not a smart thing to do. Now, John referred to differences in the numbers. There have always been some differences in the estimates. There are differences in the estimates. But we are not operating from a rosy scenario. We say that the economy can grow over the next few years at an average of 2.5% per year. That's not a rosy scenario. There were times when rosy scenarios were coming out of OMB, but not under my leadership and not under the leadership of this president. We've had very realistic economic projections, and we have proved that. We now have enough track record. So I say, as I said before, get your work done, Congress. Get the bills forward. Get the reconciliation bill to us, and probably after a veto of that bill, because it's unacceptable, we will sit down and work out a compromise budget.
Thank you. Folks, if I proposed a budget using the estimates that they did, you'd run me out of town. You would have said, we told you so. Fact is, the president said, you use the Congressional Budget Office to do the estimates. Their estimates disagree with the Congressional Budget Office by $475 billion. You have to report that. I mean, you have to report that. You can't let that get out there, that he's got some balanced budget when he's $475 billion off and the Congressional Budget Office is reporting he's $200 billion in the hole every year. There's no plan. That's why he's not in a position to criticize our plan and talk about how bad it is. Let me tell you about ours. Over the last 7 years, we spent $9.5 trillion. JFK had the first $100 billion plan in 1962. We spent $9.5 trillion. In order to balance the budget and provide the tax cuts, relief to American families, and a capital gains reduction, which everyone knows we have to do, create jobs, in order to do that, we go from $9.5 trillion to $12.2 trillion in spending. In order to do all of this, we have to strain under a $3 trillion increase. And when I go around the country and I tell people we're going to spend $3 trillion more over the next 7 years than we did over the last 7 years because we're going bankrupt, they say, what is all this talk about a revolution? Only in government could you spend $3 trillion more and talk about tight budgets. Medicare, we're going from $950 to $1.6 trillion. In Washington, some call it a cut. But $950 to $1.6 trillion, big fat increase in Westerville, Ohio. Medicaid. Medicaid's going up 37% under our plan. 37%. EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit. I don't know how you can say that people are going to have a tax increase when they don't pay any taxes. The EITC is going up under our plan in the House by 40%. It's going up. Now, in Washington, the way we're going to do it from here forward, if you spend more this year than you spent last year, we're going to call that an increase. And if you spent less this year than you spent last year, we're going to call that a cut. If you spend the same, as one reporter said, don't tell me, that's a freeze. I said, you're starting to catch on. The point is, folks, they have no plan. We can't have a good dialogue till they have a plan. You must report this fact. And in addition, our plan going from $9.5 trillion to $12.2 trillion to save this country and provide tax relief and job creation in the tax code makes all the sense in the world. And I think the American people embrace it because I think they believe it makes good common sense. About time that a group of politicians in this town dealt with the problems and dealt with them honestly.
Thank you both very, very much. And now we'll get to the questions. For Dr. Rivlin, answer that question that's been raised by Congressman Kasich and also comes up from the audience. Why won't the president offer a full-blown alternative to the GOP budget? Is it leadership to simply sit back now and say no?
We have offered alternatives to most of the Republican proposals. We put out our plan for discretionary spending in full and gory detail in the budget, which Mr. Kasich seems not to have to hand, but which has influenced a great deal, I think, what has happened in the Appropriations Committees, although they haven't seemed to have been able to get their bills forward, but they don't have any doubt about where the president stands on appropriations. We had a welfare reform plan up on the Hill that made very clear what we were for, and that has influenced the welfare reform debate. The place where we did not put a detailed plan forward, although we have one, is Medicare and Medicaid. We decided that we would let the Congress see if they could come up with a plan, and then we would negotiate with them, although we have made very clear what our numbers are and the general outlines of our plan. It would have smaller Medicare cuts. It would not fall on beneficiaries. It would have very substantially smaller Medicaid cuts that preserve the entitlement, and it would add some benefits to the uninsured. We have not had any secret about this, and if the Congress hasn't been listening, I regret that.
Can I? I feel compelled to say to you, if I got a call that I was going to be in the starting lineup for the Indians, I'd go to the game, and I'd be swinging at the fences. Not trying to get hit by a pitch. This is the President of the United States we're talking about, not giving us a complete budget and not including Medicaid and Medicare, the two fastest growing items in the federal government. Folks, we can't have that. We need leadership. We need leadership to get the job done and to ignore giant pieces. And frankly, when you look at the discretionary programs, we can't figure those out either. The President's Medicare plan is one page. Furthermore, I'll make available to all of you the differences between CBO and OMB, and they include big savings in Medicaid and Medicare based on theory with no real program, no program changes at all. It's not fair. You're the umpire. They're out at home. You've got to make the call.
All right, now we have a question for you, sir. Don't leave. From the audience. Republicans claim they are paying for their $245 billion tax cut with the fiscal dividend they get from balancing the budget over the years. But the Congressional Budget Office says the dividend is only about $170 billion. Where's the rest of the money coming from?
Let me move this step. Folks, you might recall the tax program, capital gains reduction. My dad carried mail on his back in McKees Rocks. You know why we like the capital gains reduction? Because jobs get created, and then we get the job, then we get educated, then we become successful, and we end up buying in a leveraged buyout your company, and then we're the boss, you work for us. I mean, the dream in America is every kid can fly. Every kid can be what they want to be. Capital gains is about economic growth, and there's no observers that don't think we shouldn't lower the cost of risk-taking in America, none. Family tax credit, $500. If there's any institution we ought to be reinforcing, the administration agrees with this, it's the American family. And when we cut commerce out and save $8 billion by eliminating the attic for political junkies, we ought to put some of the money towards reducing the deficit, and we ought to use some of it to give back to people who've been supporting this bureaucracy for a long time. Now, how do we pay for it? Back last March, I paid for it. I put out a whole spending list of exactly, went to the House floor and voted on it. And we paid for the whole deal. And folks, we have also now said that Medicare will not be put in the PAYGO scorecard. Now, I don't talk inside the Beltway, but the bottom line is we're not permitted to use Medicare to pay for one dime of our tax cuts. You know how we did it? We did it by trimming bureaucracy. We did it by making some choices, and we did it the way the American people would do it with their family budget. We simply made savings. And we spelled out every dime of the savings designed to offset the tax cuts of $345 billion last spring. The tax cuts are $245 now. Of course, we can pay for them. We laid it out. We had it scored by the CBO, and it works. So I could run through the whole list. I could talk about foreign aid savings. I can talk about savings in other bureaucracies. I can talk about the savings in the commerce. I can go on and on and on about it, but it was all paid for, because you know something? I can't use smoke and mirrors. I've worked too long and too hard with my colleagues like Shays and Colby and Hobson to not do it right now. That's the bottom line. No smoke and mirrors, no gimmicks, and let's do it now.
Let's talk about Medicare for a moment. There isn't any difference, I don't think, on the scoring of savings on Medicare from either side. The Republican budget has $270 billion in Medicare cuts. They talk about saving the trust fund, but again, by everybody's reckoning, you would stave off the day at which the trust fund runs out of money for 10 years with a $90 billion cut, which is what we have. We have some more than that, but we have plenty to keep the Medicare trust fund solvent for 10 years. The Republicans have a much larger set of cuts, which fall on beneficiaries, but that doesn't help the trust fund. And they don't move the date at which the trust fund runs out of money any further out than we do with their total plan.
I will get back to you. Congressman, will the Republicans move toward a compromise with the White House by scaling back the size of the $245 billion of tax cuts?
I'm not going to negotiate at the podium today, but you know, let's get one thing firmly established in our minds. When you take the tax cuts and you take the spend, the savings in this plan, our deficit reductions and our balanced budget approach has not been sacrificed because of tax relief. I kept to keep going back to the same number. $9.5 trillion over the last 7 years to $12.2 trillion in total spending over the next 7 years. Do we, you know what tax cuts are really all about? They're about whether the government should spend money or you should spend money. Now, when it gets down to capital gains, you know, we count that as a revenue loss. Chairman Greenspan doesn't think that's a revenue loss. Most people don't think the capital gains over the long haul will be a revenue loss. In fact, it'll give us a stronger economy. But we counted it that way because that's how the Congressional Budget Office told us to count it. I don't see any reason to scale back the tax relief for Americans. I see no reason why we shouldn't save money from the government, balance the budget, and let people have some of their money back. We didn't use dynamic scoring. We didn't use smoke and mirrors. Let me tell you what it's really all about. What the president needs to do is to leave the hotel and get on the field. Propose a plan to balance the budget. It's going to have some different priorities in what the size of government ought to be. We think the size of government ought to be smaller. You know what the president said yesterday? I had too many tax increases in my plan. You read that in the paper? He says, I didn't want to have all these tax increases. I didn't want to spend all this money, but the Republicans made me do it. You know what? Tim Penny, my soulmate, just in my office this morning, he and I had a proposal called Penny Kasich. It was to save a penny on a dollar of federal spending. And guess what? The president fought it. The cabinet fought it. The Democrat leadership fought it. And we lost by about 4 votes because we wanted to reduce spending. No, I think what we need to get at here is not negotiating on how much less we should give people back. After all, you know, the president raised taxes by about it's a $500 billion plan. It was giant tax increases in it, and we're only canceling out about half those tax increases. The bottom line is we need to reduce the size, the scope of government, shift power, money, and influence out of this city, and you don't do it by negotiating downward on the tax cuts. And furthermore, I think it'd be real silly of me to sit here and try to negotiate from this podium.
Dr. Rivlin, will the president move toward a compromise with the Republican Congress by accepting a capital gains tax cut that doesn't simply placate the middle class, but does stimulate savings and investment?
Well, I'm not going to negotiate at the podium either. We did not put a capital gains tax cut in our budget because we think that there are better ways to grow the economy, and a capital gains tax cut goes largely to upper income people. It makes a difference whose tax you cut, and the Republicans are raising taxes on hard-working, low-wage working families, and they are cutting them for families who have a lot of money. Now, we don't think that's right, just, or necessary.
Congressman Kasich, what about defense spending? Why is it the only major budget item to be increased? And a corollary question, why not cut down on weapons we don't need?
Well, let me just suggest that the one item of the federal government that has been declining has been defense. But let me also tell you, you can't ask me a question like that. I'm going nuts about Pentagon spending. I think we need to clean it up, and Newt's promised me that next year we're going to make the Pentagon a triangle. I'm thrilled. I can't work any harder to kill the B-2, but I wish I could get people on both sides of the aisle to get rid of it. I don't think the Pentagon ought to be jobs program any more than any other place. I don't think it ought to be a pork barrel program. I've spent a whole career trying to rein in defense spending, but I will tell you that there's a level at which we don't want to go below. And I think we need to have the weapons and technologies of the next generation. I think we need to have a high readiness of our troops. And I'm going to do my best to reform this building. If we can get the budget balanced, the blueprint laid down, and then we can move and fix the Pentagon, that wouldn't be bad to be able to achieve in a short period of time. I hope we can get it done and put the Pentagon under the microscope. And frankly, we're doing better. We just defeated the defense appropriation bill because of some pork barrel spending in it is one of the reasons. And we're going to go back and we're going to get it done. But it's a pox on both houses when it comes to using defense only to pay for national security. Finally, let me just make one comment about a deal with the president. we can get a deal that balances the budget in 7 years, we'll be okay. We're not going to make it 7.5 or 8 or 9. We're going to use real numbers. We're going to score it by CBO. We can debate the priorities. I disagree with the Senate earned income tax credit numbers, and I've made my position clear. The bottom line, though, folks, is we got to be on the same field using the same yardage stick, and we got to put this country first and lay the plan down. We can debate the priorities. Alice and I will get the priorities along with Leon and Newt and figure it out, but no gimmicks, and let's do it now.
All right, wait, before you leave, I'll get one more for you, and then I'll get back to you, but here's one I think you like. What about cutting corporate welfare programs like agriculture and export subsidies? Go through it.
Well, let me tell you, don't ever negotiate changes in agriculture. I mean, you'd rather be named an executor in an estate than to be having to negotiate agriculture, okay? Pat Roberts has done a great job in terms of trying to de-link payments to production. And at the end of the day, he isn't going to get everything he wants. But Pat Roberts, I believe, has created a momentum in agriculture reform that will not be stopped. Privatization in this country will not be stopped. We're not going to get the PMAs done this time, but there's a momentum. And it's historic what Roberts tried to do in agriculture. He deserves to be complimented for it. And we're going to get as much sweeping change in that as we can. And frankly, folks, over time, sugar program is dead. It's not going to be dead this year. But its time is coming. It takes time to make all of these changes. Corporate welfare, I think we have a lot more to do. Don't tell Archer I said that. Anyway, I believe this. You can't just take from one sector and not the other. 936 pharmaceutical tax breaks for big corporations, gone. The program of COLI, where companies have used this insurance business as a gimmick to raise funds, gone. The left for the liberals on Capitol Hill have talked for a lot of years about closing loopholes while they kind of passed them out. Not all of them, because, you know, like Ron Delms is one of my best buddies. But there's been inconsistency. We got in 9 months, and we have done $29 billion worth of loophole closings on big corporations. And you want to know something? When we did that, I felt the weight of the world lifted off my shoulders from the standpoint of trying to make this a fair proposal that deals everybody a blow. In corporate America, they didn't like it, but they don't really have any choice. They got to accept it. And I think we have more to do, and I hope on a bipartisan basis we will get it done. Thank you for having me here today. I really enjoyed it.
Dr. Rivlin, do you agree with the president that the 1993 deficit reduction package raised taxes, quote, too much?
The president doesn't even agree with that. The president has made clear that nobody likes to raise taxes. That's not fun. In fact, there isn't any easy way to reduce a budget deficit. It takes painful things, raising taxes and cutting spending. The president is proud of the 1993 agreement, as am I. We worked hard on it. We didn't get any Republican support. Might have been slightly different budget if we had, but we got it through, and we are proud of that and proud of the Democrats that voted for it. And the proof of the pudding is it's working. The people who said that the things would deteriorate if we passed this budget were absolutely wrong. And most of them are making more money than they did before and are very pleased with the way the economy and the budget policy has gone. Enough said.
All right, one more before you leave the podium. If you, as you said, oppose raising taxes on working families, what's your alternative? Will taxing the rich produce enough revenue to balance your budget over time?
We're not proposing raising taxes on the rich. We're just saying don't cut them. Don't go engage in a tax plan which differentially and aggressively favors high-income people and at the same time raise taxes on large numbers of low-income working families. We don't need a tax cut this big, and we don't need a tax cut that falls so unfairly across the distribution of taxpayers. We have revenue flowing in now. We are in favor of a moderate tax cut for people who need it. We are in favor of spending cuts. And despite the papers, I have no idea what one page Chairman Kasich is waving around. There are lots of pages in our plan. Despite that, we are in favor of balancing the budget in a moderate way over a reasonable period of years, and we don't like smoke and mirrors either.
Thank you. Congressman Kasich had to leave. He was called back to the Hill. But we will get him his certificate of appreciation before the day is out, and his coffee cup. But you're here, and you're going to get yours right now. Thank you, Dr. Rubin, for being with us. It was a pleasure. And this coffee cup, you can fill it with coffee or try to raise money balancing the budget. One way
or the other. Thank you very much.
Last question. Dr. Rubin, you'll get the last question. When are we going to get a resolution of these budget issues? Mid-November, mid-December, mid-January? What's your guess?
It will not surprise you to know that I do not know. My hope is that it can be before the middle of November. The Congress has been very slow, as I said, in getting its work done. If they speed up, they could get us the bills and we could have a negotiation and get it done before Thanksgiving anyway. If they can't get their act together, it'll drag out longer. I don't know how to guess that one.
Thank you very much for being with us, and I thank you all for attending. Good afternoon. Thank you.